This is a painting that was done by a guy named Domenico Guardiano in 1480. So it's part of the Renaissance period. But I had this to show you. And then along the same time frame is this depiction of Jerome also. Now the previous one that I showed you, that's the classic Renaissance kind of period. He's dressed in the garb of the 14th century type folks and everything. This other picture associated also with the Renaissance, it's by Giovanni Bellini. And it was also done in 1480, but it's depicting Jerome, and he's wearing the sackcloth. He's in a cave doing his translation work and that kind of thing. So it's so dark. Sorry about that. It probably doesn't do it justice. I'm not sure how to brighten that. And then a few years later, a guy named Bartomeo Cavorzi in 1670. This is also Jerome. Those are two angels that are there ministering to him that he had depicted. But this is the Baroque period. And the only thing I wanted to bring out about the difference with these is simply the depth of color that he uses on this. It shows much darker. But also in the pictures themselves, they show contrasting light and shadows and those kind of things. That was typical of the Baroque period as opposed to Renaissance. So there you go, cultural edification for the period. Mm-hmm. Moving on, though, for Jerome. He's called the greatest figure in Bible translation. He was extremely ascetic with a nasty disposition. That's the best way I can put it, Josh. Sorry. He just had a nasty disposition. He showered his opponents with sarcasm and abusive speech. Now then, he was born in 340. Do what?
Sounds like a good guy.
He was an argumentative guy, that's for sure.
He was Italian.
He was born in 347 in Stridon, which is near the northeast side of Italy, up on the above the boot, so to speak. His formal name is Eusebius Hieronius Sophronius, which I got no idea how we get Jerome out of. I asked the pastor that. Sam, if you've got any insight on that too?
I think that...
And he was the son of Eusebius. It's not our Eusebius that we studied earlier, but like I said, there were a bunch of folks named Eusebius during that time frame. Now, his parents were Christian, but the other thing to point out about his parents is that they were somewhat well off. I don't want to say they were like high society, but they were well off to send him off to school and that kind of thing. When they did that, he was well educated in Rome. He studied grammar, rhetoric, and philosophy. And Molly, what's rhetoric?
Math.
No, it is not math.
Well, you're so pretty good at this one.
I look.
Theater. Theater.
No. No. Well, we know what grammar is. We know what philosophy is. But I looked up rhetoric, and the definition of rhetoric is the art or science of all specialized literary uses of language in prose or verse, including figures of speech. It's the study of effective use of language, the ability to use language effectively, the art of prose in general as opposed to verse, the art of making persuasive speeches and oratory, and finally, the art of influencing the thought and conduct of an audience. So that's all rhetoric is. And now, I'm going to tell you that he studied under a guy named Donatius, to which at this point, y'all are supposed to all go, ooh. Because he was like this big wig in Rome, teaching and that kind of thing. So it was like the cream of the crop being one of his students kind of thing. At that time, he's about 19 years old, and he decides he's going to be baptized, so he gets baptized, and then he goes on this little journey of finding himself. So he's going to go on this little pilgrimage thing, but like any good guy, he's going to head up north to Germany and visit some folks there. Yep. But he finds himself, as he goes through this, he's going to end up in southwest Germany, a little place called Trier, and Aquinia, which is also in Italy. And he's going to meet a guy named Rufinius. Rufinius, we're going to find out later in life, does these translations of Origen and that kind of thing. So those are the kind of folks he meets. But instead of doing what a 19-year-old you'd think would be doing, looking for the sensuous life and that kind of thing, he is more more bent towards the aesthetic life. In other words, he's going to push aside all the entrapments of Roman society and everything and look, say, that's for them, not for me. And he's going to go towards the minimalist life. Yes, ma'am. He's going to go off by himself. He's got money. It's kind of like, I won't say the prodigal son, but he goes off. There's going to be some other guys that he hangs out with, like Rufinus. There are a couple other guys he hangs out with that travel with him. Those two actually die along the way. He gets pretty sick on one of these things. But like I said, in 373, he's going to decide that I want to do the pilgrimage. I'm going to go to Bethlehem. I'm going to the Holy Land. So that's what he's planning on doing. That's what the goal is. Well, he makes it as far as Antioch, okay, which isn't really that close. But he makes it as far as Antioch, and he continues his Greek studies. He's going to study under Apollinarius of Laodicea, who we talked about, Apollinarius. Remember, he's the guy that felt Christ was all God. He had a human body, but he really didn't have that human soul and human will, human spirit. He was God with just a fleshly body. He doesn't buy into all that, but he spends some time with him. In 375 AD, he has this dream. And in that dream, he's actually had been sick for part of this time, but in this dream, he was standing before the judgment seat of Christ. And during this time, he's being accused of being a Ciceronian. A Ciceronian was someone, and the claim is that you prefer the pagan literature to the Christian literature. Ciceronian was a person that lived back during the time of Julius Caesar and all that period. He was an orator. He was a statesman. He was very well known, very well respected, and did have a following. He wrote literature and that kind of thing too, and to which Jerome did read his works. And he enjoyed them. Well, it shook him to the core when he's standing before the judgment seat of Christ and being accused by Christ, saying, "You're not a Christian, you're a Ciceronian." To which he wakes up in a cold sweat and says, "I'm not going to read any more pagan literature whatsoever. I'm going to study the Bible." And so for the next 10 years, that's what he does. He does eventually roll back into reading some other works and that kind of stuff. But for the most part, that's what shakes him up. Okay, so he's in Antioch. He's going to move out to this place called Chalice. And it's over by Greece. He's going to be living in a cave at that point. During this time, that's when some of his friends moved with him. That's when they're going to pass away. Yes, sir?
Sorry, does he stay in Antioch for 10 years while he studies, or does he leave Antioch at all?
In 375, that's when he's going to move to Chalice. He's going to stay in Chalice for roughly about 4 years. He's going to meet a Jewish convert there that's going to teach him Hebrew, which is a big deal in the big scope of things. And he's going to return to Antioch. In Antioch, that's about 379 or so that he goes there. He's going to meet this guy named Bishop Paulinus, who ordains Jerome as a priest. The one thing I kind of cut out is that during this time that he's in Chalice, he's also doing some translation work. He's doing some letter writing. So his name's kind of getting out. Even though he enjoys this aesthetic life, he enjoys writing. And then as a result of that writing, Paulinus is going to read some of his work. And he's pretty excited when Jerome shows up in Antioch. But Jerome has conditions on being a priest. Remember, he's kind of an ascetic guy. So he doesn't want to buy into doing the priestly functions. In other words, I wrote this down. Whoops. Sorry about that. Let me read this quote from you that he had. It says, "In Chalice, he took up ascetic living again. It was hard. He hated the food. And Jerome also wrote, 'Though I was protected by the rampart of the lonely desert, I could not endure against the promptings of sin and the ardent heat of my nature. I tried to crush them by frequently fasting, but my mind was always in turmoil of imagination.' One of the things that he did, like I said, was he took up Hebrew. And that was one of those things that got his mind off a wandering imagination. For all the guys, we know what that means. But it had him focused on the Hebrew and what he was going to, and learning that. So that really helped him doing that. But again, he was living in a rock cave. He copied manuscripts, wrote letters, but it was just, he could only take so much of it. It was time for him to move on. Now, one of the things he did when, as a condition of his becoming a priest under Paulinus, he attended exegetical lectures. He examined gospel parchments, and he met with other theologians. So he kind of shunned the whole human element of being a priest and devoted himself to studies and those kind of things. And that's what he wanted to do. And he got what he wanted, so to speak. So in 382, he's summoned to Rome. At this point, there's another guy there named Pope Damas. Pope Damas I appointed him as secretary and librarian. That was kind of a big deal. Now, Damas wanted to use him because he was so good at his writing. Damas wanted to kind of use him as his writer, if you will, his ghost writer, that kind of thing. But Damas had also identified him as a possible successor. Why in the world Jerome was identified as a possible successor to the Pope, I have no idea. Because his people skills were just not there. He was smart as all get out, but why that they identified him, I'm not sure. But this was also when he was commissioned by the Pope to write the Bible into Latin. Now, that was a big deal. Again, that was about 382. However, in 384, Damas dies, which leaves him in a little bit of a quandary here. Another note. Jerome falls out of favor when the new Pope shows up, and the people around him as well. This is just this one section I wanted to read for y'all. It says, in 382, he was summoned to Rome to be secretary and one possible successor to Pope Damas. But during his short 3-year stint there, Jerome offended the pleasure-loving Romans with his sharp tongue and blunt criticism. As one historian put it, he detested most of the Romans and did not apologize for detesting them. He mocked the clerics' lack of clarity. His quote is, "I have not faith in mercy, but such as I have silver and gold, that I don't give to you either." Yeah. To their vanity, he wrote, "The only thought of such men is their clothes. Are they pleasantly perfumed? Do their shoes fit smoothly? Their pride in their beards? If there is any holiness in a beard, nobody is holier than a goat."
Wow.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah. And their ignorance of Scripture? "It's bad enough to teach what you do not know, but even worse, to not even be aware of what you do not know." So that's what he wrote about these guys. And as a result, surprise, he fell out of favor. Yeah. Well, I think part of it is going to be attributed to living in sin, but I think the other side of it is he believed in this aesthetic style to the point that if you don't believe what I believe, I'm going to attack you. And though you may not be living to the extreme that the others were, he didn't have very much compassion on that.
I would accuse him of having caustic wit.
Yes. That is... And you would be very accurate in that. So as a result of that, he heads back east. And where do you think he wants to go?
Germany.
What? What? No, further east.
Bethlehem.
That's where he wants to end up. So in 386, he's going to settle in Bethlehem. And one of the things, during this brief time, he meets some wealthy benefactors. Even though he's short with people, He knows which side the butter's breaded on, or butter's breaded, or what bread's buttered on. So he makes these friends with these wealthy benefactors, and the it's a husband and wife. The husband passes away. The wife ends up building a monastery for him, and not just for him. She builds also a nunnery for the ladies and that kind of thing, and some other work. So there's a lot that's going on there that's he's supported by. So Paula is the benefactor for him, and so the monastery is built for him in Bethlehem. He remains in Bethlehem for the next 34 years. He writes several commentaries. He completes work on the Vulgate. And though I haven't mentioned it, the Vulgate is going to be the Latin Bible, is what that is. And then he dies eventually in Bethlehem on September 30th, 420 AD. And the reason I included the September 30th is simply because the Catholics still celebrate it's a special day of observance for Jerome on September 30th, so they have all that. He was roughly 73 years old when he passes away. Now, as a result of his work on the Vulgate, one of his big contributions is he developed the use of philological and geographical material in his exegesis and recognized the scientific importance of archaeology. That was one of the quotes I found in the materials I read. But that was his contribution to the translation process and everything. And no, I had no idea what the word philological meant. So, the word philological means the study of a language in written historical sources is a combination of literary criticism, history, and linguistics. It's more commonly defined as the study of literary text and written records, the establishment of their authenticity and their original form, and the determination of their meaning. And so that sums up kind of Jerome in terms of his translation and what he brought to the process. Again, he was probably the first one to go into the translation business like this anyway, aside from the Septuagint. And the Septuagint, which will also, was done by roughly 70 writers. That's what Septuagint means, right, Pastor? 70. And so there were 70 people that came together to create the Septuagint. Now the Vulgate, like I said, is a Latin Bible. That means, Vulgate means common or commonly known. So what was going on outside the church? Why do we need this kind of thing? Do what?
The Greek language, it was going out of favor as far as common language.
Do you want to read my notes?
No. You asked what's going on in this time period.
Well, when was that, though?
You said it was in the 400s during your lifetime.
By roughly the 3rd century, Greek was still popular up until that point. And the Romans thought of themselves as a continuation of the Greek civilization. They wanted to be like the Greeks in terms of their design and architecture and literature and all that kind of stuff. But eventually the Romans were Romans, and the common language was Latin for them. So roughly in the 4th century, Latin became the predominant language. The problem that you had, though, is you had an east and west side. The east side of the church spoke Greek. The west side of the church spoke Latin. And Damascus wanted to do something about this. There had been some Latin Bibles that were attempted, though. So someone was trying to do something about this problem. But there were two main problems to this. These Latin Bibles were not the product of a careful study of ancient manuscripts, and that the Latin translations were not the best. In other words, their word translations were rather informal. One guy said they were too colloquial. They weren't technical enough. And so that's why these Latin translations that had gone before failed. The other problem they had is that they just hadn't been, if you will, sanctioned or authorized by anybody. The Pope or one of the priests or whoever may have been making the decisions didn't say, okay, I want you to do this. It wasn't like that. These people had just taken it up upon themselves to do this. And consequently, they just didn't have the same clout, if you will, as the original Greek version had of the Septuagint.
Obviously important to one pope, but it wasn't important to the next pope.
I think the, and Pastor, you may correct me on this, I think the problem they were finding is that they're probably losing out on patrons because they were going to do everything in Greek regardless. And if you didn't understand Greek, they just had people maybe sitting in chairs and not understanding the things that was being said to them. Mm-hmm. Consequently, you get fallout from that. Was there anything else going on, Pastor?
Lots of east-west, eastern empire, western empire politics that were going on.
Yeah. I don't think it was like where they have a Latin ceremony and a Greek ceremony or service or something like that. Yeah. You did because they told me to be there. I had another section for you too. This is what Damascus wrote to Jerome regarding his desire for this Latin Bible. He said, if we are to pin our faith in to the Latin text, Damas once written to him, it is for our opponents to tell us which, for there are many forms as there are copies. If, on the other hand, we are to glean the truth from a comparison of many, why not go back to the original Greek and correct the mistakes introduced by inaccurate translators and the blundering alterations of confident but ignorant critics? And further, all this has been inserted or changed by copyist more asleep than awake. So he had a little bit of a tongue on him too. The idea was that there were several Latin versions, but none of them were the same. Each of them had their own little flavor. And consequently, guy trying to write something on this in defense on this side, it was maybe not the same over here. Yes, sir.
Yeah. Because I remember when I was in school, the friends that I had that went to the Catholic Church, mm-hmm. it was in Latin then. So that's kind of a modern day comparison.
Yeah.
To back then.
That's a great comparison, Tim.
I think the service was in Latin. I don't think the sermon was, though. Because the sermon's what the priest's opinion on whatever.
I did go to a Catholic service once, and the singing was in Latin. Some of the, I don't know, it's not chants, but it's the, pardon?
Liturgy.
Liturgy, yes, that's it. So it was just kind of different like that. Let's see. So I put on here, what made Jerome, that is, uniquely qualified for this? Well, Jerome could speak, write, and understand Latin, Greek, and Hebrew, so he was trilingual. He studied and could read Aramaic. I didn't tell you all that, but that was something he had picked up along the way. And he also had that background in rhetoric. So he could take the things that were written that were in Greek and even Hebrew and translate them accurately into Latin. And so that's why he had done that. One of the writers said that it was an incredible blessing for Jerome to be kicked out of Rome at that time and devote himself to this, because if he had stayed as Pope, then they wouldn't have gotten the Vulgate. So there. Now then, the Vulgate itself, going back to the translation, he was initially asked to translate the Gospels by Damascus. He wanted to have Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John translated from the Greek that they had into Latin. So that's what he first started doing, and he accomplished that. But he really enjoyed the Hebrew stuff, and so he started working on Psalms and then worked his way into the rest of the Old Testament. So a lot of the work that Jerome did was actually in the Old Testament. And it was a little bit controversial, too, because when Jerome came to Hebrews, there were difficult texts he had in Job. And so what he did, instead of going to some of the other Catholic priests and that kind of stuff, or priests and whoever else, he went back to the Jews. He went to the back to the Jewish rabbis and asked them, what does this mean? Can you help me with this translation kind of stuff? To which the Krigs would reply that his work that he created was tainted by Judaism. So, but that was what Augustine, St. Augustine, who was a pope, also had, was a critic of his and this work that he had completed. Augustine also thought that Jerome was driving a wedge between Christians of the East and the West, since the Greek-speaking Christians in the East, since there were Greek-speaking Christians in the East still using the Septuagint, so he thought it was just furthering a wedge between the two sides and everything. And again, this work had been commissioned by Damascus, but it was Augustine, a successor pope, who was going after him. Not the immediate successor, but one of the successor popes going after him. The other thing that he had done also, when he initially started this work, I want to say, on the Vulgate, he went to the Septuagint. Remember, the Septuagint is a Greek translation of the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. And at first he went through, especially the Old Testament, looking at that. Well, he didn't feel like that was accurate. He wanted to go back to the original Hebrew. So he went back to the original Hebrew manuscripts that he could find. He actually found some work that Origen had used in some of Origen's studies. It was Hebrew work that he used in creating the Old Testament books and that kind of thing. He did all 39 of them. The other thing that's, and I guess I'm going to get ahead of myself, I don't want to do that. But it was somewhat controversial that he would skip the Septuagint, in his translation and go back to the Hebrew. Some of the guys didn't like that. They thought he should be translating from the Septuagint rather than from the old Hebrew Bible, the old Hebrew manuscripts. So he was kind of knocked on that as well. Augustine favored this word-for-word translation going through, whereas Jerome wanted to do what he called a sense-for-sense. Today, that's referred to as a dynamic equivalence. But Jerome believed that even though the words may differ, the sense or the meaning that I'm trying to convey, that was going to be the same from the Old Testament, from the old stuff to the new. Yes, sir?
It's like the difference between NASB and NIV.
Okay, there you go.
The dynamic is your NIV, and NASB is your word forward.
Okay, so there you go. But it was a completely different concept at the time to do something like that. Thank you, Pastor. The other thing that he did, the Septuagint included several books that were not part of the Hebrew Bible, and the rabbis didn't view them as inspired. It's kind of like that apocryphal side. So they had the Book of Wisdom, Ecclesiasticus, I think that's Tobit, Judith, Baruch, and 1st and 2nd Maccabees. He didn't believe those things should be in there. He said they were books, good Christian history kind of stuff, Christian history, but they shouldn't be in there. The rabbis believe they shouldn't be in there. They weren't in the Hebrew Bible. But St. Augustine said, no, they need to be in there. So as a result, the Catholic Bible has the Apocrypha in it. During the Reformation, those things, the Protestants decided, no, it doesn't belong in there. So the Protestants kind of sided with Jerome in that argument. Let's see. And Josh, you'll like this part. He had some quarrels with some of the translators on this. Remember, he's that spicy kind of guy. It says his comments sometimes used personal invective, which is derogatory comments, against his opponents that by today's standards seem harsh and sarcastic. For example, Jerome had a running quarrel with another Christian commentator named Rufinus. That was his friend from way back when. In the preface of his translation of Ezekiel, because he did these translations of all these books, but then he went back and he'd do commentaries on them as well. So he was doing this commentary on the book of Ezekiel, and Jerome wrote of the recently deceased Rufinus, "Now that the scorpion lies buried," and he continues on. He once described the heretic Pelagius. And Pelagius was one who, he was a Celtic priest who denied original sin. In other words, the sin that Adam, because Adam sinned doesn't necessarily mean that I have sin within me. We don't believe that. But he believed that that was Adam's sin. He was responsible for it. I don't have original sin within me. He furthermore would go on to say, at least in some scholars' viewpoint, that salvation is by my efforts and not by the work, completed work of Christ. So he was labeled a heretic. But to which Jerome said, or called him, one of the most stupid persons whose wits were dullied too much by Scottish porridge. Yeah. But, yeah. But it also said that Jerome did not even spare the biblical prophets. He remarked that the quality of their rhetoric made his skin crawl. Now, yeah, reading Jerome's commentaries and his 117 surviving letters leads to a good conclusion that Jerome loved a good argument. So, that's our guy. Now, his work on the Vulgate lasted... Again, like I said, he didn't create everything. What they did is they took the works that he had done, initially creating all these things, the Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. There are some folks that think that he did go on to do the rest of the New Testament. But those corrections or that version, he just made minor changes to it. It went from Latin or from Greek into Latin, but it wasn't a real difficult or laborious work for him. It was just more... Superficial than anything else. But he's credited for the four Gospels for sure and all the Old Testament. But even at that, even when he passed away, the whole Vulgate hadn't been assembled yet. It was later folks that would come along and actually assemble everything. He would receive credit for it, but that work would last for over 1,000 years, or roughly 1,000 years, until the Council of Trent, in which they went back and reissued the decree for the translation to be done, and they would go back to the Greek for the New Testament and that kind of thing. But they'd also use some of his Vulgate work as well in creating the new Bible and that kind of thing. There were other achievements he had or other things to just note. He started a school for boys in Bethlehem. He served as a spiritual guide for the monks and the nuns in Bethlehem. He also gave shelter to refugees who came to the Holy Land following the sack of Rome in 410 by the Vandals. So he did have a compassionate side to him. Let's see. The final thing I had for you guys, this is one of the quotes he had. There was another quote, and I could not find it, but this is a quote that I wrote down for y'all. He said, "Love the Holy Scriptures, and wisdom will love you. Love wisdom, and she will keep you safe." Now, Jerome, one of the guys I read said that he wasn't the greatest theologian. He comprised the second most Latin commentaries and writings associated with that time. The only other one to exceed him would be Augustine, and that was one of his contemporaries. Like we talked about before, you know how he lamented the fact that he had gotten involved with the pagan reading and all this kind of stuff. I don't think at the time when he was going through all that he understood why he was going to need it. He just knew at that point that he lamented doing it. But God had a reason for him going through that period of time learning under those guys. Yeah, they may not have been the most stellar of guys, but he learned a lot of good stuff and was able to use that in his translations of the Vulgate and that kind of stuff. The only thing I was going to tell you, Will, simply because you're in that early stage of your life, there are going to be things that God put you through that you're not going to quite understand why. And you may look back temporarily with regrets of why did I do that? Why did God have me here? But in the long run, those are going to be things that God may use. You may be a soccer coach one day. Who knows what it's going to be? But I hope and pray that you look back and don't have regrets about, because his regrets, I don't think as he looks now, he would say they were regrets or anything like that. But at the time, he just couldn't imagine why he had done those things, are why God had allowed him to go through those things, I guess I want to say. Is there anything else you want to add, Pastor? I know we're a little bit short on time. Sorry about that. Thank you all very much. I appreciate it.